Welcome to the Israel Daily News Podcast. I'm your host, Shanna Fold, and I'm here to get you caught up quickly. I've got some top news stories for you today from Israel, and guess what? You're listening, so you're already on top of your game. Survive and thrive, people. Knowledge is the best weapon. Today is Thursday, May 7th, 2026, in the Gregorian calendar, and the 20th of Iyar, 5786, in the Hebrew calendar. And my birthday is coming up in 2 days. Very excited about that. Stay tuned for the end of the show, where we will have a Torah thought by Rabbi Yossi Madvig of Oswego, New York. Now, let's get to the news. Binyamin Moalem is deeply engaged in Israeli current events and policy discussions. We're having him on today to talk about Yair Lapid and Naftali Bennett, who have decided to join forces and run together in the next Israeli election. We're also going to talk about what's happening in Iran, the UAE, Israel, regionally right now, and make some sense out of that. Binyamin, our political analyst, has worked for a foreign law clerk at the Supreme Court of Israel, so he has a unique vantage point on Israeli jurisprudence. Binyamin now devotes a lot of his time to curating and explaining current events and politics in Israel on his popular Instagram page, By Moalem, where he provides balanced news coverage from an Israeli perspective for those seeking to be informed without an extensive time investment. Binyamin has authored several thought-provoking featured op-eds and has been featured as a guest lecturer at Bar-Ilan University in Israel. Let's bring him onto the show. Welcome to the show, Binyamin Moalem, our political analyst. Thank you for taking the time out today to go through all the changes that we are seeing, both about the Israel regional war as well as the political scene that is happening here within the borders of our tiny little country. How are you?
Good. Thank you, Shanna, for having me back.
It's my ultimate pleasure, and the listeners of the Israel Daily News love you. So tell us what is going on with the Iran-Israel-U.S. conflict. Where are we at right now, and what can we expect?
All right. So yesterday, President Trump surprised us yet again, said that there were very close to a deal with Iran, or at least implied that. Then he also issued a post on social media saying that if Iran doesn't agree to the deal, the bombing will start. We've kind of seen this playing out where he kind of projects optimism and then Iran pours a little bit of cold water on it. The Speaker of Iran's parliament, Mohammad Khalibaf, tweeted last night, almost mocking President Trump for lifting the closure. Remember, President Trump earlier this week declared Project Freedom on the Strait of Hormuz, where the U.S. would provide safe passage for ships trying to traverse the Strait of Hormuz and go around the Iranian blockade. Two ships did manage to get through. However, the plan was put on pause. Initially, President Trump said because progress was being made on a deal. Yesterday, a report said that the pause had more to do with lack of cooperation from Saudi Arabia, which wouldn't allow U.S. planes to fly over. Whatever the case, there are reports saying that the U.S. put another proposal on the table and suggested that Iran was surprisingly positive about it. Now, before we get into the details of the deal, when we talk about Iran being positive about it, we're probably talking about their civilian leadership. But the key is the IRGC. Are the generals going to agree to it? They've taken a very hard line so far. And, you know, we're talking about hardliners versus very hard, you know, extra hardliners in the IRGC who do not want to make any concessions at all to the United States. They want to nationalize the Strait of Hormuz, charge tolls. And President Trump obviously is not going to agree to that. And also, they don't want to make any concessions on their nuclear program. Now, so what's in this deal? We have two almost conflicting reports. I wouldn't say they're complete conflict, but one is a little bit more, one is stricter with Iran than the other one. The report yesterday from Axios said that reported that the proposed deal would have a ban on nuclear enrichment in Iran for 12 to 15 years, that Iran would have to relinquish its stockpile of 60% enriched uranium, 450 kilos. Would also then, after the enrichment ban ends, they would be able to enrich uranium up till 3.6% as a maximum, which is what is needed for civilian use. Iran also would have to commit to very strict oversight provisions, meaning the UN, perhaps even the US, would be able to keep an eye on what Iran is doing with its nuclear program. And so that's and the deal would be done in stages, meaning the initial stage would be the end of the war, the gradual reopening of the Strait of Hormuz in both directions, and then over the next month, the two sides would negotiate a nuclear deal. And then after the nuclear deal goes into place, eventually the sanctions on Iran would gradually be released. And if at any point no deal is being able to reach, the US would be able to reimpose the blockade or restart the war. Now, there have been similar offers on the table before that Iran absolutely would not agree to. But for whatever reason, the US sounds that this time might be more optimistic. Again, we could expect an answer from the Iranians even, later tonight, if not in the next few days. President Trump said yesterday he would give them a week. So there was another report in the Wall Street Journal today that gave terms that were a little bit stricter on Iran. Instead of a 12 to 15-year freeze on nuclear enrichment, we're talking about a 20-year freeze, according to the report today in the Wall Street Journal. And Iran would be able to then, after the 20-year period, they'd be able to enrich uranium till the 3.6% limit. And also, it said all enriched uranium would be relinquished from by Iran. Now, Iran has that stockpile of 450 kilos of 60% highly enriched uranium, but they also have about 10 tons of uranium enriched between 2% and 60%. And that also, especially the uranium that's enriched at 20% or above, is a potential threat if they enrich it further. So it's key, and this was a nuclear expert who was interviewed yesterday on Israeli News. He was a former UN worker at the UN who used to be involved in the nuclear oversight of Iran. He said that Iran needs to relinquish all of that uranium in order for this to be a good deal as far as Israel's concerned, because, even if it's enriched to 20%, once they rebuild their centrifuges, rebuild their nuclear facilities, they could put that in there and get to weapons-grade uranium at a relatively quicker pace than if they have to go back to their uranium mines and start mining uranium all the way back from the beginning. So, yes, there's going to be time. And, one of the questions that I get, I'm sure your listeners have, how would this deal be any different than the 2015 JCPOA? And I think this is something that a lot of people are thinking about. You hear from the critics of President Trump saying, well, he did all this just to get back to square one to where he was when he left the Iran deal 8, 9 years ago. And I think again, we don't know all the details of whatever this proposal is. We're all basing this on reports, so we don't know what's in it till there's a written report, or sorry, a written deal on the table or that's signed. We can look at it and say, like, okay, the JCPOA said this, this new deal says that. But based on the reports that we're seeing, there are three things that we should be aware of. Is number one, the JCPOA did never ban Iran from nuclear enrichment. From the get-go, Iran was able to enrich uranium at 3.6%. This deal would put a pause on all enrichment for a period of 12 to 20 years. Apparently, reports say that this new deal would have stricter oversight provisions. So, meaning there'd be more surprise inspections and other inspections that would ensure that Iran would not have any sort of nuclear weapons, include and would ban all enrichment of uranium or any nuclear research to be done below ground. Everything would have to be above ground, and they'd have to shut down certain key nuclear sites that are underground. And most significantly, at least I think, is that we're talking about a situation here where Iran is starting from square one. Its nuclear facilities have been destroyed. It has no nuclear enrichment capabilities right now because they've all been destroyed, mainly in the June war last year. Whereas during the 2015 JCPOA, Iran already had all the infrastructure. The infrastructure wasn't going anywhere, and then they were just bound by the terms of the deal. So, meaning the clock has been set back on Iran compared to where it was in 2015 because of the war. Again, we'll have to wait until there is a deal in place, if there ever is a deal in place, to determine what's the difference between this and the JCPOA. And some might argue that, okay, but those differences aren't as significant because Iran currently has this large stockpile of enriched uranium, something it didn't have in 2015, something that it developed since then. So then, we're not that much better off right now. Again, people could argue those points, but I think it's important to highlight what the differences are, if there are any at this point, that we can talk about.
Thanks for bringing all of that up. There's definitely a few things that are coming up for me as I listen to you talk about this. First of all, the Iranians have been leading with negotiations regarding the Strait of Hormuz and having a communication like, first we're going to deal with the Strait of Hormuz, we're going to get back to you with regarding the nuclear program next week, next week, next week. And it's very interesting to me how this conflict has been able to be shaped by the Iranians, that at first this war broke out over its nuclear program, over the weapons and missiles that they're launching into Israel and the rest of the region. By the way, the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, is dealing currently with missiles coming from Iran, and that has led a lot of Israelis to think that Israel is next to receive a barrage of missiles. So I'd like for you to note, to comment on that, but also so to say that we started from a place of what's going on with the nuclear program to now, because Iran sort of manipulated their access to the Strait of Hormuz, saying, okay, we're going to figure out whether we're going to keep this Strait of Hormuz open to international passage or not. And completely shaping and moving the scenario into a two-tiered sort of system where first the Strait of Hormuz needs to be addressed and then later we can deal with the nuclear program, when really at the crux of this whole thing was initially and foremost the nuclear agreement. When I'm listening to you talk about the JCPOA stuff, and what I really want to say is surprise inspections, going from underground to above ground. I mean, these are all things that sound nice, but sincerely, Iran has been caught so many times not being within the bounds of that JCPOA agreement back then. And of course, President Donald Trump pulled out of that deal in his previous term because there were so many infractions. And so little to trust of the Iranian regime. So a question that I have for you, and then I want you to address the stuff about the UAE and about how it's possible that Iran has been able to shift the focus from the nuclear program to first dealing with the Strait of Hormuz, is my question is, just to start with responding to why Iran is targeting the UAE right now with missiles, and does that mean that Israel is next? Should we expect to be fired on within the next day or two?
Okay, so I think that so long as the President Trump doesn't want to escalate the war and restart the war, I don't see Iran aiming towards Israel right now with its attacks. Yes, it targeted the UAE a couple days ago, and it sees the UAE as kind of a low-hanging fruit. The UAE is not going to respond militarily. President Trump, and I think where you were going was that President Trump, you know, we saw this cycle of, you know, nuclear program. Iran discovered that it has this leverage, the Strait of Hormuz, and it's been using it, some might argue very well, as terms of leverage on President Trump, because this blockade has had a significant effect on oil prices around the world, and specifically gas prices in the United States. Gas is at $4.50 in the United States, $4.50 a gallon in the United States, which for the US is almost astronomical. Speaking to somebody who's right now in Israel, where gas prices, if you translate it into dollars and gallons, is about $9 a gallon, if not more, people might not understand that people in America are complaining for having gas prices that are half of those what they are in Israel. But in the United States, this is very high for gas prices. And the Iranians know that he's feeling that pressure. And he also has midterm elections coming up in November. And so President Trump wants this all over with by November, or probably sometime before November, so that he can, you know, campaign on this victory and ride that into the election season. And so the Iranians know all we need to do is survive this blockade, which, by the way, is having a significant impact on the Iranian economy. Estimates last week said that they have lost about $5 billion in oil exports, and they stand to lose a lot more in terms of permanent damage to its entire oil infrastructure and oil if they have to shut down oil wells. They're nearing capacity in their storage facilities, whether it's on Karg Island and other areas. Reports say they've been becoming very creative in finding places to store the oil so that they can keep the oil pumping. If they have to shut down those oil wells, it'll be catastrophic damage. They'll have to rebuild them from scratch almost, which would cost billions of dollars. Dollars that they don't have because they've lost so much money because of the war, because of the damage to their exports in general, and to their oil infrastructure. So now they want to put more pressure on President Trump. President Trump announced Project Freedom. They attacked the United Arab Emirates. President Trump was like, that doesn't meet the threshold for breaking the ceasefire, because he doesn't want to go back to war. And if Iran were to attack Israel, that means going back to war, because Israel's not going to just take that laying down. Even if President Trump doesn't retaliate, Israel will retaliate. And they know that. So I think the attack on the United Arab Emirates is low risk from Iran's perspective. You know, they attacked, what they did was they attacked, I believe they have one oil facility that's on the coast of the Gulf of Oman. So it circumvents the Strait of Hormuz. So meaning if the UAE wants to ship out oil and avoid going through the Strait of Hormuz, they can do it through this one port that's on the southeastern end of the United Arab Emirates on the Gulf of Oman and avoid the Iranian blockade. Iran doesn't like that. They want to shut down all oil production from the Gulf states. So that appears to be what their target was. I don't see now. President Trump has paused a Project Freedom, so Iran is probably not going to attack the United Arab Emirates, and they're definitely not going to attack Israel unless they feel like the war is imminently going to restart, because they know that an attack on Israel will mean a retaliatory attack on Iran.
Okay, thanks for going through that. How different, I know that you already explained the differences, but do you think, Benjamin, that going into a deal at this point would be like just a different version of the JCPOA, or, you know, a version with more, with heavier restrictions, let's say? Or do you think, because there's been actual shots fired and deaths, that the scenario is different at this point?
So again, we have to see what's in the actual deal, if and when one comes about. Obviously, the situation on the ground right now is very different than it was in 2015, where Iran had the infrastructure in place for developing a nuclear weapon, or at least enriching uranium to the point where it can be used in a nuclear weapon. Whereas today, they don't have that infrastructure. It's been largely destroyed. However, what they do have this time, which they didn't have that time, was a stockpile of highly enriched uranium. So that would need to be relinquished. And I don't think the U.S. will agree to any deal that doesn't see that being sent out of Iran. President Trump said the other day that he sees it coming to the United States. Unclear that Iran will agree to send it to the U.S., maybe to Russia or some other country. But yeah, we'll have to see what the details are of that deal. One more thing that I think is interesting to note, there was a report yesterday from an senior Israeli intelligence official who said that he assesses that if the blockade remains in place until the end of 2026, he doesn't see the Iranian regime being able to survive past that time, meaning that the economic damage to the IRGC will be so significant by the end of 2026 if the blockade remains in place, that the regime will not be able to survive. Now, again, I was asked yesterday, okay, well, if they do that, why doesn't the U.S. just do that? Well, the U.S. has other interests, right? Oil prices, midterm elections, and the Iranians know this. The Iranians say, like, we're going to play chicken with President Trump. We're going to dig in. At least this has been the IRGC's position throughout this negotiation period for the past month. And we're taking our hits, but right now we're the only game in town here in Iran. And President Trump lives in a democracy and he has to answer to his voters. So if we just dig in and wait this out, we'll be able to survive. President Trump could say, you know what? He could take it one of two ways. He doesn't appear to want to go back to war. He could leave the blockade in place, but then, you know, gas prices in the United States stay high. His popularity stays low at the cost of eventually, you know, it's high risk, high reward. If he can get the Iranian regime out by the end of the year because of this blockade, he'll be able to boast victory that nobody else was able to do. And, you know, to him, the summer of high gas prices would have been a small price to pay for this. Yesterday, I think he said he was prepared to go to oil being $250 a gallon in exchange for, you know, winning this war against Iran's nuclear program. Right now, they're about half of that. I think a little bit less than half of that, if he really meant that they would go that high. So, again, this is essentially comes down to being a game of chicken between the IRGC and President Trump over the blockade and the Strait of Hormuz.
Okay, great. Thank you for explaining all of that. Are you ready to move into the internal politics here in Israel?
Yeah.
Okay. So we had a big news announcement that Naftali Bennett and Yair Lapid, both former prime ministers for a short stint, are partnering and they're running together in an effort to defeat the current prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. As we know, and as our listeners should know if they had heard your very good, clear explanation in our previous podcast about politics, here in Israel, you don't vote for people, you vote for parties. And so I can't quite say that they're trying to necessarily defeat Netanyahu, because it would be their party that needed to defeat Netanyahu's Likud party, as it is called. But we can make the shortcut and say that. So, Benjamin, explain to us why this move has come to be, and actually take us through what happened with Yair Lapid, because he was in a rotation. He was set up for a rotation when he, quote unquote, got into office. And tell us what happened there.
All right, yeah. So when they were both elected in 2021, they set up a rotational government by which Naftali Bennett would serve as prime minister for the first half of the term. Yair Lapid would be for the second half of the term. Obviously, it would have been 2 years and 2 years. The government only lasted a little over a year. So Naftali Bennett was prime minister for a year. Lapid was prime minister for 4 months. And what happened since then was that Lapid, who got 24 seats in the last election, is not doing very well in the polls, and just to put it mildly. Before this merger between the two, Lapid was polling at about six seats, two seats above the four-seat threshold. So in order to get into the Knesset, you need 3.25% of the popular vote, which is equal to four seats in the Knesset. You get less than four seats in the Knesset, you get zero seats. And so Lapid wanted to guarantee his political future and the political future of some of those who sit in his party. And for Naftali Bennett, who has been polling at over 20 seats for quite some time while running alone, he wanted to guarantee his position as the leader of the opposition bloc, right? Right now in Israel, you've got the Netanyahu camp, with the current coalition, and then you've got the opposition, which is the anti-Netanyahu camp. Used to be Israel was divided along right-left lines. Today they're divided along, do you want Netanyahu to be prime minister? Do you not want Netanyahu to be prime minister? And it's kind of an interesting alignment, because Naftali Bennett is arguably to the right of Netanyahu on many of his political views in terms of Israel versus its neighbors, Israel versus the Palestinians, for sure. Whereas Yair Lapid is, I wouldn't call him a staunch leftist, but some might make a good argument that he's slightly left of center in his views. When it comes down to it, at the end of the day in Israel, almost all Israelis, or the overwhelming majority of Israelis, are, by the measures that we would have calculated politics 20 years ago, are right-wing, in the sense that nobody believes that, at least not for the next generation, there can be some sort of negotiated settlement with the Palestinians. So right now, who is the best person to manage the conflict and kind of pave the way towards the future? So that kind of, the other issues that are kind of more divisive in Israeli society are now, how should the government be run in terms of, one big thing was the judicial reforms. Judicial reform, the idea of having some sort of judicial reform prior to this current government, was actually quite popular. Majority of Israelis wanted reforms. However, when the current government rolled out its reform plan, most Israelis were opposed to it. They said it went too far. That's one example. The Haredi draft, obviously, is a big thing. And these are things that Lapid and Bennett are more ideologically aligned on. Now, the problem for both of them is that they alienate many of their core, the base voters in this alignment, right? Bennett attracted many people who were right-wing, staunchly right-wing, and they were kind of sick of Netanyahu. There is this kind of like group of, six Knesset seats, let's say, who they voted for Netanyahu, Likud, in the last election. And you correctly pointed out that in Israel you vote for a party, but ultimately when people are voting for a party, they're usually voting for they're voting for the person who leads that party, right? Even though there's a whole list of Knesset members behind Netanyahu and the Likud, behind Bennett and Lapid and their new party, behind any party leader, In Israeli, they look at a party, and to them, they're looking at the party leader as the flag standard bearer for that party, and that's who they want to lead, if not the country, to lead what the ideals that they are voting
right.
for. And so people who are voting for Likud are, now again, there are many in Israel. I'd say Likud is one of the last legacy parties from the founding of the state that are still, like, you still have people who, they're Likud voters in their blood, regardless of who the party leader is. But, you know, people voting for Bennett's party, for example.
Want to make like one little note here that I've heard from Israelis whenever we talk the differences between Israeli and American politics. And I like to bring this up because we have a lot of American listeners and it's a little bit difficult for the American to understand what's going on here politically. Israelis like having a multitude of parties to choose from, at least a lot of Israelis that I've spoken with. And they've asked me, how is it possible that in the United States you have a left and a right, which means that you kind of put all your eggs in one basket. So here in Israel, you could be a right-wing conservative Torah scholar who believes that all people should enlist in the IDF, and they might find a party that more closely aligns with that. You can also find somebody who's really left-wing, but they believe that the Supreme Court needs reform because it's an old man's club and, you know, whatever. There's a lot of variety in the parties, and there's a lot of variety in thought and political ideology. And so while the Americans might come here and feel that things are difficult and there's too many options and there's too many choices, Israelis feel that the system is too binary in the United States. So I just wanted to give a little color on that for our listeners.
Yeah. I mean, and again, one of the big differences is, though, in the United States, you're voting for a person, whereas in Israel, you're voting for a whole list of like you said, ideas. But I think ultimately when you go to the ballot box, most people, there are exceptions. Haredim, especially those who vote for United Torah Judaism, the Ashkenazi Haredim, they're going to the ballot box. They are voting for the party that the rabbis told them to vote for, United Torah Judaism. And but when people go to the ballot, they're saying, like, okay, well, when they're voting for Bennett, they're voting for Naftali Bennett to be prime minister. They're not voting for his party, meaning the people who he's going to place on his party list to sit in the Knesset with him are a lot less significant to the average voter than the person sitting at top of the ticket. And that holds true for most of the parties that are running for office in Israel. And yes, as you pointed out, when coalition politics also requires many compromises to be made. So yes, you might vote for a party that specifically aligns with what you want, but when that party gets into the Knesset, they're going to have to make concessions on some of the things that they believe in to favor some of the other things they want. And sometimes they are, again, bribery would be the wrong word here, but it's kind of this form of political horse trading of, like, you make me foreign minister, well, I'll vote for your agenda on the Haredi draft or whatever it is. And we see that right now in the government. And this is not unique to this government. This happens in every government where, you know, you can't, you know, two parties are sitting in Knesset that have opposing views on a Haredi draft, for example, won't be able to sit together unless one gets something that it wants, and one's going to get something that, and also at the same time going to get something that it doesn't want. There are many Knesset members who are in the current government who do not internally support the Haredi draft bill that's on the table, which is very unlikely to pass at this point, I think. But they would have voted for it just because of the nature of coalition politics. And sometimes that works in the reverse, too. You've got laws that the Knesset will either pass or fail to pass because you'll have opposition members who, even though they agree with the content of the law, they'll vote against those interests because they want to stick it to the coalition. Something that I don't get, I think this is playing politics in all of it, but you know, there have been many situations where the opposition will vote against the bill that they, in any other constellation, would vote in favor of because they want to stick it to the coalition and try to bring down the government. So that's the nature of coalition politics, for better and for worse. You know, getting back to this merger between Lapid and Bennett, we have a situation here where we've got people who are not close to being aligned ideologically. You know, they're not polar opposites of one another, but they're not exactly on the same page. And they also knowingly sacrificed votes, because you'll have voters who are staunch right-wing voters who will say to themselves, you know, I like Bennett. He's right-wing. I'm sick of Netanyahu. What they're trying to do, they're trying to pull voters from the other block, because right now Netanyahu is sitting in a coalition with a majority. They need voters from that coalition to come over to the opposition in order to win the next election. And Bennett was kind of a very attractive option for many people who thought that, you know, Netanyahu did not take responsibility for October 7th. He was the prime minister on October 7th. And, you know, I'm kind of sick of him. I don't want to be prime minister anymore. Naftali Bennett's a great alternative. Well, now that Naftali Bennett is sitting in the same party as somebody who I view as a leftist, as not me personally, but the voter, that voter will say, like, okay, well, I don't want to vote for a party that has somebody who I believe to be a staunch leftist. I'm not going to cast my vote for him. You know, if you think of someone like Yair Golan, who heads the left-wing Democrats party, to many people on the right, Yair Lapid is no different than Yair Golan. So I'm not going to vote for a party that Yair Lapid is in. And so Naftali Bennett had to know this when he agreed to this merger. And the same thing, perhaps to a lesser extent, for Yair Lapid. You'd have many moderates who are like, you know what, I think Yair Lapid was very good. He's moderate. I want to vote for somebody who's moderate. Well, now he's sitting with somebody who I think is a extreme right-wing fanatic. I'm not going to vote for a party that's headed by a right-wing fanatic. So I'm going to go to a different party. And polls show that they did lose 1 to 2 seats from that merger. So that asks, why do they do it? Like I said, Lapid wants to ensure his political future. And Bennett wants to solidify his position as the head of the opposition bloc. Because he goes from, you know, 20, 21 seats in the polls to 27 seats in the polls. And at 27 seats, someone like Gadi Eisenkot, who had been polling at 15 seats, isn't going to be able to challenge him for leadership of the opposition bloc, and not going to be able to kind of extort the premiership if that opposition bloc does garner a majority in the next election. So he wants to be like, okay, now I've solidified a majority, even though it's costing me, meaning the two of our parties together, we are giving up seats. Polls do show that those seats go to other parties in the opposition bloc, not back to the Likud, though I think it's a little bit too early to tell. I think it's certainly quite possible that somebody who was ready to jump ship on Netanyahu to vote for Bennett now will go back to Netanyahu because, you know, they look at the opposition bloc. Maybe they'll vote for Eisenkot, you know, conceded to be as right of center. Maybe they'll vote for Lieberman, who's just as right wing as Naftali Bennett. But Lieberman perhaps might not be as aligned with them on issues like church and state. Like, Lieberman is a staunch secularist, whereas Bennett is himself religious. So they might not feel comfortable voting for one of those two parties and go back to the Likud. So this was a calculated risk by both Bennett and Lapid, probably more by Bennett than it was for Lapid. And another development we saw this week is that Avigdor Lieberman and Gadi Eisenkot have been in touch about possible mergers. Now, Lieberman has been very, very upfront about the fact that he is not going to agree to any merger that costs the bloc seats, or costs him seats. He's like, if the sum of 1 + 1 does not equal at least 2, if not more than 2, I'm not going to enter into any mergers. I'm running alone. So I'd be very surprised if he agrees to this merger, and the only way they would agree to this merger if internal polls show that the two of them joining together would pull seats from Netanyahu, which is possible. Gadi Eisenkot kind of positioned himself to attract the more traditional voters. Lieberman actually this week took on two religious people to join his Knesset list for the next election, probably in an effort to kind of send the message to the more traditional Likud voters, like, hey, I'm not going to impose secularism. I'm not trying to run this secular agenda. I've got religious people on my party list. You could come vote for me. I'm a safe right-wing vote and a safe vote for those who are more moderate religiously. So these are moves taken by, and Gadi Eisenkot also just took the former Yoram Cohen, who's a former Shin Bet chief, also a religious person. So it seems like they're trying to position themselves to try to pull those Likud voters who don't love this merger between Bennett and Lapid, but might be looking for an option in the opposition bloc to vote for. And now these talks between Eisenkot and Lieberman might be taking that one step further. Finally, I think one thing that is very important to note is the need for each block to have an even number of parties. Why are an even number of parties important? Israeli law allows for what are called vote-sharing agreements, whereas two parties who are similarly aligned ideologically can sign one of these vote-sharing agreements, and the remainder of votes, right? For example, Israel has a proportional electoral system. So let's say, for argument's sake, each seat in the Knesset is worth 10,000 votes. It's more than that, but to keep this an easy calculation. So let's say one party gets 12,000 votes, another party gets 18,000 votes. Both parties are only going to get one seat because each you need at least 10,000 to get to the next threshold. A vote-sharing agreement allows each party to share the remainder of their votes with their partner that has a higher remainder. So if party A has 12,000 votes and party B has 18,000 votes, party A can give its remainder of 2,000 votes to party B, and now party B can get that second Knesset seat. So where vote-sharing agreements are very important here is where the Netanyahu bloc, where in the last election, for example, there were exactly four parties. Likud, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir ran together, UTJ and Shas signed a vote-sharing agreement, Smotrich and Netanyahu signed a vote-sharing agreement. That kept all of the votes within that bloc in-house. So meaning none of the votes went to waste. However, the opposition was disorganized. Not all the parties had vote-sharing agreements. Meretz did not cross the threshold. And so tens of thousands of votes, I think over 300,000 votes went to waste in the opposition bloc. The vote was much closer in terms of the sheer numbers of people who voted for one side versus the other. But it ended up being 64 to 56 because so many more votes in the opposition went to waste because of a lack of organization. Netanyahu was very, the Netanyahu bloc was very disciplined. Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, they don't get along necessarily. Netanyahu was like, you guys are running together so that you guys can sign a voter agreement with me, Shas and UTJ, and all the votes in our camp are going to stay together. The opposition was not as organized, and that's something that the opposition undoubtedly will be very aware of this time around. Now, it seems that right now, what we've got, you've got the new merger between Bennett and Lapid as one party, you've got Lieberman's party, you've got Eisenkot's party, and you've got the Democrats, Yair Golan. That's four parties. Another merger would bring us down to three. So something that these parties are going to keep in mind, and they're also going to learn the lessons from the previous election. The other, if you're Netanyahu right now, you've got to be thrilled with this merger between Bennett and Lapid. You know, now he has every reason in the world to paint Bennett as a leftist, which is almost a slur for some groups in Israel, and because he's sitting with Lapid, who many do view as a leftist. So this is great fodder, and Netanyahu has wasted no time, or at least his campaign camp has wasted no time in highlighting this. Now this kind of jockeying between Eisenkot, if Eisenkot and Lieberman, for example, were to merge, and you have two parties that are very close, the infighting between the two parties trying to jockey for, the leader of the opposition camp might cost them more votes than it will gain in the end. So something to keep an eye on in the months ahead as we head towards what appears to be an October 27th election, though there was a report last week that the Haredi parties are trying to pressure Netanyahu to move the elections up to September 1st. September 1st, of course, is less than 2 weeks before Rosh Hashanah, and the days of awe, the high holiday season in Israel, is a good way to get out the vote amongst the religious and traditional voters in Israel, who they believe will be more likely to vote for a right-wing or Netanyahu bloc party that close to Rosh Hashanah. So something to keep an eye on.
Thank you so much, Binyamin Moalem, for going through this with us today. The two hottest stories of the week coming out of Israel. We are lucky to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Shana. Good to see you.
And now for a Torah thought by Rabbi Yossi Madvig of Oswego, New York.
This week's Torah portion is actually a double portion, Bahar and Bechukotai, and we read the Haftorah. The custom is to read the Haftorah for Bechukotai, the second Parsha, and just like a good chunk of the Torah portion is talking about the sabbatical year, so too, this Torah portion discusses observing the sabbatical year and what happens if you don't observe the sabbatical year, where, in case you don't know, the sabbatical year is sort of like Shabbat, but for a whole year for the land. So for 6 years, you're supposed to work the land, you know, plant and sow and so on and so forth and reap and do all the things that you have to do, harvest. But in the sabbatical year, that has to be stopped and everything has to be allowed to grow by itself. And you take what you need and everyone else can take what they need. And it's sort of ownerless, so to speak. And at the end of the Haftorah, the prophet, this is Jeremiah, he says that if you forsake God, then you will be shamed, and your graves will be marked in the earth, for they have forsaken God, their source of living water. And then it says, heal me, God, and I will be healed. Help me, and I'll be helped. And the idea of the living water, the Mayim Chayim, is water that flows from a spring, right? You could have different kinds of water, from a well or from a lake or from a river. And this is from like a spring, a wellspring, that's perpetually coming up, right? It's called alive because it's always active. It doesn't dry up and it's always surging upwards and it's always moving. And the consistency for the of the spring shows how it's kind of like it's alive. And therefore, it's used to counteract various types of ritual defilement, which comes from death, right? Which is the opposite of life, right? The most serious types of this ritual defilement of tumat met, of defilement from a dead body, is you use living water, this mayim chayim. And because only God is absolutely eternal, so he is the source of all continuity, all of life, and especially the living water, which conquers the spiritual negativity, which is associated with death. And so we say to God, heal me. And this not only refers to, you know, physically healing us, but especially healing a spiritual sickness, right? In order to heal a physical sickness, what do you have to do? You have to go to a doctor, right? The Torah tells you, go to a doctor. And that it's God who gives his power of healing to those doctors. So we don't say, okay, it's the human being that's helping me or the medicine that's helping me. Obviously, it's God's blessings, it's God's energy, but it's coming through this medium. So just like physical sickness, you have to have proper hygiene, right? If you neglect yourself, if you don't have healthy habits, you don't have proper hygiene, so you'll have a physical sickness. So it's the same thing with spirituality. A spiritual sickness comes from neglecting healthy spiritual habits. And just like in a physical sickness, you probably have a fever when you get an infection. So too, in a spiritual sickness, there's this fever, this burning desire for physical and temporal gratification. And the way to get rid of a physical, the way that you have in a physical fever where you have a loss of appetite. So in a spiritual sickness, you also will lose your appetite, so to speak, for studying Torah or for doing the commandments. And a typical symptom of this loss of appetite for holiness is that you might think that, oh, if I just take away from Torah and mitzvot, if I ignore the Torah and don't pursue holy things, right? Maybe I don't have to be so particularly honest in my business. Okay, I can work on the Sabbath. I don't have to give so much charity. And you start to chip away at that. So that will lead to even more of the spiritual sickness. And it's just the opposite is the case. It's not going to help you at all. Elsewhere, the prophet Jeremiah, he refers to all of this as forsaking God, right? The source of living water. He says, in order to dig wells, broken wells that can't hold water. You think you're trying to get rid of the living water and you're going to your man-made wells, it's not going to work out as well for you. And so the process of spiritual healing begins by taking that desire for unholy things, or even just not holy things, even if they're not unholy, but even if they're just not holy, and replacing that with this desire four holy things, a renewed enthusiasm for prayer, for learning Torah, for doing the mitzvot, the commandments. And it's especially helpful to even commit certain passages to memory, if you can, to repeat words of Torah by heart whenever you can. Wait, maybe just a verse of Psalms or a verse from the Torah or a Mishnah, anything that you can that's holy. Even if it's, you know, a lot of times you put it to a song, you know, you just walk down the street, sing a song that's quoting a verse of Torah. This not only helps you spiritually, but also it spiritually purifies the air from where you're walking. And so the ultimate healing, of course, will happen when Mashiach comes in the future, when that living water will flow out of Jerusalem, as the prophet Zechariah says. And on that day, God will be one and his name one. Shabbat Shalom.
All right. Well, that is it for today's show. Today is Thursday, May 7th, 2025. Tel Aviv has a low of 17 degrees Celsius and a high of 21 degrees. That's 63 degrees Fahrenheit, going up to 69 degrees for the high. We are everywhere. Don't forget to sign up to our Israel Weekly News Wrap. The Israel Weekly News Wrap is a newsletter with the top five stories coming out of Israel from throughout the week. And of course, it has a personal note from me at the top. You can go over to israeldailynews.org, which is our website. We have a lot of interesting new content on there, by the way. And you can scroll down to the bottom and drop your email address in. Have a great and productive day and an excellent weekend. Hope to see you on the mailing. Shabbat Shalom, everyone.